I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing Gar Alperwitz. He wrote this, well, first of all, he's a historian who's written a ton of extremely important books, including The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb and Atomic Diplomacy, Hiroshima and Potsdam. And he's got this one in The Nation from a couple of weeks back, August 6th, anniversary time. The war was won before Hiroshima, and the generals who dropped the bomb knew it. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Gar?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. And it's such an important article that you wrote. There's so much to talk about regarding the atomic bombing, but you focus right on what is probably the most persuasive and educational point for the average American, which is all of the extremely credentialed criticism of the use of that bomb. That contrary to what we're all taught in fifth grade, that this was an absolute necessity, everyone who you would think agreed with that back then, turns out, didn't.
Well, it's certainly true that the top generals and admirals, the ones at the very top, almost all of them went public immediately after the war, which is very hard to imagine. The President of the United States had made a decision, and many of them went public saying the bomb was totally unnecessary. The war was going to end shortly in any way, without an invasion, and the bombing was almost entirely about civilians. Hiroshima was not a military center. There was a small installation there, but it was a very marginal. It was basically a civilian target, and the generals and admirals, many of them old conservatives, weren't taught, as one of them said, to kill women and children unnecessarily. So it is quite amazing to find General Eisenhower went public saying it was outrageous. Curtis LeMay, the famous bomber pilot that bombed all of Tokyo, immediately after the war came out saying the war was going to be over within a couple of weeks. This was outrageous to bomb all these civilians. I can go on. The list is long, 20 of them I counted, who are top people, five-star generals and admirals of the fleet admirals. It's quite an indictment. Most of them conservatives, not liberals or radicals, old-fashioned conservatives who just didn't believe in killing women and children. It's important to know that Hiroshima was not a military target. There was a small installation there, which was a little training unit, but not very large, which meant that with the young men, Japanese men, off to war, who was left were women, old people, and kids, basically. That was the population that was decimated with the bombing of Hiroshima.
Mm. Now, with these men that you've cited here, with most of them, I mean, I'm asking for a generalization, but would they have supported the atomic bombings if they thought that they were necessary and they just knew that they weren't necessary? Or, I mean, necessary, quote unquote, to end the war then, rather than let it, continue on? Or they would have rather invaded the place than drop the bombs, but still to get that unconditional surrender?
I think the first, let me back up. The intelligence estimates at this time, starting in April 1945, remember the bomb was used in August, several months later. The intelligence estimates said the Japanese are close to surrender. When the Russian army attacks, the Russians were not in the war, when they attack, that will precipitate an immediate surrender. And the reason is that the Japanese feared Russian invasion, communist invasion, more than anything else. They would rather have been invaded by the United States if they had to be invaded. So U.S. intelligence and British intelligence made this argument again and again, starting in April 1945, when the Russians entered the war, as long as they can keep their emperor. And we had decided long ago they were going to keep the emperor because we wanted to use him after the surrender to control the Japanese people. So we were going to keep the emperor no matter what. So they knew the war would end if you kept the emperor and the Russians attacked. And since we didn't know whether the atomic bomb would work, it was unknown until July of 45, we were desperately begging the Russians to come in because that would end a war without an invasion. So that was the plan up until August 1945. The Russians will come in. They were scheduled to come in 3 months after the German invasion, take them that long to move their troops into position across Siberia, long kind of problem to mobilize the whole thing and move all the troops and tanks. So they were scheduled to come in on August 8th and at our request, and because intelligence said that would end the war so long as we let them keep their emperor, which we're going to do anyway because they could control the Japanese people. The bomb, there was at Potsdam, a proclamation was instant, a big conference in Germany in July of 1945. The proclamation was issued by us warning Japan to surrender. It famously contained a paragraph saying, you can keep the emperor, because we knew they would not surrender. They saw the emperor as a god. If we didn't say that, if there was any doubt about the emperor, this god figure, they would not surrender. That paragraph promising them they could keep the emperor as a figurehead with no power was extracted by the Secretary of State. And the reason he extracted it, it's now obvious and clear, he didn't want them to surrender. And the reason he didn't want them to surrender was he wanted to use the bomb rather than have a surrender either then or when the Russians came in, which is what the military intelligence said would happen. He said, when the Russians came in, tell them we weren't going to harm their god figure. He could be a figurehead like the King of England. Tell them that when the Russians come in, the war is over. And by the way, there's 3 months to test this because we can't even do a landing for 3 months. We can't land till November. We aren't in position logistically to do that. So we kept them fighting by taking away assurances for the emperor. The Russians were scheduled to come in on August 8th. Hiroshima was bombed on August 6th. The Russians attacked on August 8th. Nagasaki was bombed on August 9th. So that's the sequence. And as I said, and as we now know, endless documents about how the military figure, many of these old conservatives, were just outraged at the killing, an unnecessary killing of civilians with this, what Eisenhower called that terrible thing, the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm. Now, on that question of the unconditional surrender there, when you say the Secretary of State changed that in the official declaration there at Potsdam, you're also saying, though, that inside the U.S. government, there was no change. That they had decided long ago. It wasn't just that MacArthur decided for expediency later. They had decided long ago that, of course, we'll keep the emperor. But they kept that a secret, essentially, and demanded total unconditional surrender so that they couldn't get it.
Yes, that's right. That's right. They knew that they were going to keep the emperor in a powerless position in order to help control the Japanese people, and particularly the Japanese army, once we invaded and were occupying Japan. That was the plan. Mm-hmm.
But it's not like, you know, for example, I'm just making this up, but a contrary narrative would be, well, there was a big debate inside the government whether to let them keep the emperor or not, or something like that. In other words, This was a solid decision. There was no wavering on the decision. The only wavering was in public for Japanese consumption.
Yeah, exactly. The plan was, this is the best way to, once we have an occupation of Japan, the way to do it is to keep the emperor as a figurehead because he will keep things under control for us.
Yeah.
That was always the plan.
Hey guys, Scott here. I've got some books you should read. The War State by Mike Swanson, a great history of the early Cold War. No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Bodakhshani. how to run your computer business like a good libertarian. Oh yeah, and don't forget Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, by me. Hey y'all, here's the thing. Donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, and you can get a QR code commodity disc as my gift to you. It's a 1 ounce silver disc with a QR code on the back. You take a picture of it with your phone, and it gives you the instant spot price and lets you know what that silver, that ounce of silver is worth on the market in Federal Reserve notes in real time. It's the future of currency in the past too. CommodityDiscs.com or just go to scotthorton.org/donate. Hey guys, you know, you probably need a new website. A lot of people do. What you need to do then is go to expanddesigns.com. The great Harley Abbott and his team over at expanddesigns.com, they'll hook you up with a great new website for 2019. And in fact, what you really should do is type in expanddesigns.com/Scott and you'll save $500. Okay, now, so let's go back, because you said you could go on all day about the names of these men. I wish you would. Take your time and go through and remind us. I mean, who is Admiral Leahy? Why would we listen to a guy like him? This kind of thing, most
okay,
of us.
Okay, Admiral Leahy, he was a fleet admiral, 6 stars. You can't get any higher than that. He was chief of staff to the President of the United States. He was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the combined U.S.-UK Chiefs of Staff. He's about as high as you could get at that time. A very conservative old admiral. Here's what he said, and a very good friend of Harry S. Truman, the president. Here's what he said after the bomb was used. Quote, "The use of this barbarous weapon at Hiroshima and Nagasaki was of no material assistance in our war against Japan. The Japanese were already defeated and ready to surrender. In being the first to use it, we adopted an ethical standard common to the barbarians of the Dark Ages. I was not taught to make war in that fashion. Wars cannot be won by destroying women and children." That's a direct quote from this conservative fleet admiral Leahy.
And now, one of these that's very interesting to me is Curtis LeMay, who, I don't know if you could call him conservative. He was certainly a right-winger, maybe more of a radical than a conservative. We all know that he was perfectly willing to use H-bombs on China and Korea when the opportunity presented itself. So he was no humanitarian. But again, he's, I guess, speaking just, this is the Butcher of Tokyo, but he's speaking just in utilitarian terms, that this was unnecessary.
Here's this is a press conference from General Curtis LeMay, September 20th, 1945. The use of the atomic bomb, quote, had nothing to do with the end of the war. The war would have ended over in 2 weeks without the use of the atomic bomb or even the Russian entry into the war. You mean, and the press says, you mean that, sir? This is a press conference. Without the Russians, without the atomic bomb, LeMay, the atomic bomb had nothing to do with the end of the war at all. And it goes on that the war would have ended anyway, as most of them think. That's what U.S. intelligence said.
And you mentioned also Ike Eisenhower, who was the 5-star commander of United Nations forces in Europe and later president of the United States.
Yeah, let me see if I can find Eisenhower. I've got a list of these collected. Here he is. He's talking about, and I'll give you a couple of quotes. He's talking about when he was told before the atomic bomb was used by the Secretary of War. And here's his quote. "During his recitation of the relevant facts, I was conscious of a feeling of depression. And so I voiced my grave misgivings, first on the basis of my belief that Japan was already defeated and that dropping the bomb was completely unnecessary. Secondly, because I thought our country should avoid shocking world opinion by the use of a weapon whose employment was, I thought, no longer mandatory as a measure to save American lives." After he was president, he was president of the United States. In a 1963 interview, he was quite blunt. It wasn't necessary to hit them with that awful thing.
And can you talk about Nimitz and MacArthur, who were the two major commanders of the Pacific Theater? They both condemned it as well.
Yeah, here's what we have from MacArthur is recollections from two different people. This is one, Richard Nixon, President of the United States, recalling that, quote, General MacArthur once spoke to me very eloquently about the atomic bomb, pacing the floor of his apartment in the Waldorf. He thought a tragedy that the bomb was ever exploded. MacArthur believed that the same restrictions ought to apply to atomic weapons as to conventional weapons, that the military objective should always be limited damage to non-combatants. MacArthur, you see, was a soldier. He believed in using force only against military targets, and that is why the nuclear thing turned him off. And then Mark MacArthur's pilot, Weldon Rhodes, the day after Hiroshima, this is the pilot who was his personal pilot, noted in his diary, General MacArthur definitely is appalled and depressed by this Frankenstein monster. I had a long talk with him today, necessitated by the impending trip to Okinawa. So I think that there's no doubt, but what MacArthur was saying was just, that was almost all the top military felt the same way. They just weren't taught to bomb civilians when it was in general, or particularly when it was unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. And Nimitz, there's the American class of aircraft carriers are named after him, and he was in charge of the whole kind of Southern campaign in the Pacific, and it was his forces at Iwo Jima and all that, right?
Exactly.
And then, so what did he say about it?
Well, this is a he went public at this was an address 2 months after Hiroshima at the Washington Monument, actually. Quote, the Japanese had in fact already sued for peace before the atomic age was announced to the world with the destruction of Hiroshima and before the Russian entry into the war. The atomic bomb played no decisive part from a purely military standpoint in the defeat of Japan. You have to understand what's going on here, because these are the top leading military people of the United States Army and Navy fighting in World War II. These are not secondary figures. And this is immediately after the use of the atomic bomb. They're going public attacking what the president had just done. It is, you know, it's amazing and reflecting on it. Military is usually very quiet about the commander-in-chief's decisions. And here you find one after another of them. Not all of them. Some of them waited till they'd written a biography or their personal recollections. But a number of them went public after the war. Mm. Curtis LeMay being the most interesting, and Admiral Nimitz being another one very interesting.
Yeah. Well, and it really just goes to show the irony of, you know, American power in this age where we're constantly having to rely on the military men to restrain the passions, I guess, of the civilians, when it's the standing army that at the end of the day still is the greatest threat. But sometimes they prefer to not be so misused and advise the civilians to be a little bit less worse than they would otherwise be, when it's the civilians' job to rein them in all the time, supposedly.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. These were, you know, I'm hardly a conservative myself, but these were virtually all very, very conservative generals and admirals who were very serious about defending the United States. And they were also very serious about not being, you know, I think McNamara once said, had we lost the war, we'd all have been war criminals for bombing all these cities and people, civilians.
Yeah. And by the way, for anyone who's too young and doesn't know and has never seen that film, The Fog of War, it's where McNamara finally comes clean. And he was guilty, not just, you know, in Japan, but also in Korea and Vietnam, of burning so many people to death. And then at the end of the day, he says, yeah, I guess I shouldn't have done that. Sorry.
Yep.
Not sorry, but slightly regretful or something like that.
Yeah.
And now I'm sorry, because I know less about General Hap Arnold and Admiral Bill Halsey. Can you tell us about them?
Well, let's see. Hap Arnold was the guy who was running the Air Force at this time. And let's see if I can find the quote from him. And again, it's the same thing throughout, that these people knew the war was over, that the military it was not a question. The intelligence was very clear. It was going to end when the Russians came in. The Japanese were desperately, you know, on their last legs no matter what. So here's the kind of thing you got from him. Asked 10 days after Hiroshima, this is the head of the Air Force. This is, again, going public by the New York Times. The Japanese position was hopeless even before the first atomic bomb fell, because the Japanese had lost total control of their own air. In his memoirs, Arnold observed, "It always appeared to us that, atomic bomb or no atomic bomb, the Japanese were already on verge of collapse." And here's his deputy, General Ira Eaker. By the way, as you can imagine, these quotes were from a book that I wrote called The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb. I just assembled all the quotes to find out what the military was doing at mm-hmm. the time and assembled them. You can find them in that book. Here's Arnold's deputy, General Eaker. This is in an internal military history interview. This was inside the U.S. military. They very often do interviews trying to find out what actually happened and for historical purposes and for training purposes. Here's Eaker talking about Arnold, who was head of the Air Force. Arnold's view was that the dropping of the atomic bomb, was totally unnecessary. He said he knew the Japanese wanted peace. There were political implications in the decision, and Arnold did not feel it was the military's job to question it. Eaker reported further that Arnold told him, when the question comes up of whether we use the atomic bomb or not, my view is that the Air Force will not oppose the use of the bomb, and they will deliver it effectively if the commander-in-chief decides to use it. But it is not necessary to use it in order to conquer the Japanese without the necessity of an invasion. So again, it's virtually all of these admirals and generals at the very top who knew what was going on had exactly the same view. The war was just about over and the bomb was totally unnecessary and shouldn't have been used.
Yep. Well, I have anecdotes like this, and I've also heard tell of a lot of anecdotes like this too, where people get into real arguments with friends or family members or a guy at a bar or whatever, where the position that you're taking is essentially believed to be something that only the most horrible and hateful anti-American people could ever say. And don't you know that millions and millions of Americans would have died trying to invade Japan and all of these crazy things? That's an actual quote from President Bush Sr. Not just a million, but millions and millions, he said. And people really believe that stuff. But then what happens is what we've just gone through here. These quotes of these men are just the ultimate antidote to that, because it doesn't just say, actually, that's not quite true. Look at some of this criticism. I mean, this is the ultimate criticism. McNamara and Nimitz and Ike and LeMay and all these people. And it's incredible. It's shocking to people who have never been taught this. They don't ever teach us this. Other than at antiwar.com, right? You don't get this stuff in school. And so it's the kind of thing that'll really make a light bulb go on, that not only have I been wrong, but wow, man, maybe there's a whole other world that I was living in than the real one. If this many men, and as you said, conservatives, Republicans, right wingers, lifelong military men, the heroes of World War II, they were the ones, the leaders, not, as you said, not secondary figures, not pencil pushers back at the Pentagon. The quote unquote greatest men of that greatest generation, they were the ones who said we shouldn't have done this. So where does that leave us then?
Well, it is quite shocking. I mean, because this material has been available. This is not secret material. It's been available for a long time. So it's been avoided, not looked at. And people have found it very, very difficult to believe what I think is true, and that what all these, and I agree with these people, the military leaders, that the bomb was totally unnecessary, was aimed primarily at a civilian target. Hiroshima was not a military target. It did, as I said, it had a very small training base there, but that's not why they chose it. They chose it because they liked the target. They thought it would show what the bomb could use. It was a very nice design city that would show off what the bomb could actually do. That's why they chose it. And mostly old people, young kids and women left behind as the young men went to war. So it was clearly and there's been research on this lately, some very good legal work. It was clearly a war crime. It was an international war crime. to bomb any civilian target, which is essentially what Hiroshima was, and particularly when there's no necessity. So it is an outrageous story that we Americans have not wanted to talk about, except for these leading conservatives. I'm hardly a conservative, but I have great respect for these old serious conservatives who were dedicated to, you know, protecting the United States. They were honorable Army and Navy and Air Force guys who were trying to do their duty, but they just did not believe in killing women and children unnecessarily.
Yep. And now, so there's been a lot of talk, I think especially this year, you know, there's always a little bit of talk, you know, in August, every anniversary, some writing and that kind of thing, which I'm grateful for. I guess we shouldn't take that for granted. The work's got to be done to get done. But it seems like this time around, part of the discussion has been about kind of more specific questions about what Truman knew and when he knew it, what they told him, what he really believed, and whether he really thought he was nuking a military base. And I guess there was a Twitter thread by this historian talking about whether he really had any idea they were going to hit Nagasaki 2 days later, that he apparently, according to one document, it seems like maybe he didn't realize that we were going to attack him again until the end of the month or something like that. What do you think about that stuff?
I have not seen any serious documentation of that kind. I pretty much know this literature fairly well. I've done two big books on it. That doesn't mean I couldn't have missed something, but everything we know about the decision is that he was aware of the basic intelligence and that he understood what was happening. He was, it is what really the story in human terms was, Truman was way over his head. He was a senator from, you know, without any experience in this. He knew nothing about what was going on in the war. Roosevelt died and he was thrown into this position in April, kind of trying to get his sea legs. He was dominated at this point in time, in my view, and I think it's pretty well understood by historians, by the man he chose to be Secretary of State, and who was really the person who was involved, who essentially guided Truman. His name was Secretary of State James Byrnes, B-Y-R-N-E-S, of South Carolinian, a very important figure in the New Deal, and very conservative and very very slippery. His biographer wrote, titled the book Sly and Deceptive or something like that was the title of the biography. Very, very slippery guy. And he had taught Truman when he became a senator. Byrnes was a senator at one point. He was Supreme Court justice. He was governor of the state. And he ran the domestic economy for Roosevelt. He was a very powerful figure. He had also been at the Yalta conference when Roosevelt met with Stalin. So he was on the inside of everything. But he had personally been in the Senate, kind of Truman's kind of guiding figure when Truman came in and didn't know anything about the Senate as a young senator from Missouri. Byrnes took him under his wing and taught him the ropes. Well, Truman made Byrnes his Secretary of State when Roosevelt died in April. And he also gave him basically control of the decisions about what to do with the emperor and what to do with the atomic bomb, pretty much. So that's the guy to look for if you see who it's very much like George Bush was run around by his vice president, Cheney. Byrnes is a figure like Cheney. Running around a young Truman who was just fresh in and didn't know what he was really doing at the outset. And Byrnes is on record saying at the time a bunch of scientists came to him in April of 1945, or maybe it was late March. It was in April, I'm sure, of 1945. A bunch of scientists came to them who were atomic scientists. And they said, look, we all know the war is over. You really shouldn't use this thing. It's very dangerous. You're going to start an arms race that could lead to the destruction of the world. And Byrnes said to them, I know the war's over, but I want to, and this is a quote, we need the bomb to make the Russians more manageable, unquote. And so Byrnes, there's a lot of evidence that Byrnes saw the bomb as a weapon against the Russians, not the Japanese, both because he was worried about Eastern Europe. He'd been on Yalta. He thought using the bomb would scare them and they'd back off of Eastern Europe. Highly unlikely that they would relax there because the Germans had invaded twice, Russia twice. And also in Asia, he thought in Manchuria, the Russian army, if we didn't get the Russians into the war in Japan, they wouldn't come into Manchuria, and maybe we could have more influence in that area. So, but Burns explicitly did say to these scientists who recorded it and wrote it down, no, I want to use the bomb because it'll make the Russians more manageable. And the scientists were shocked because they knew, anybody who was in the inside who thought about it for 5 minutes, if we use the bomb to scare the Russians, or even if we use the bomb without any attempt to try to do some negotiations, they will have to get an atomic bomb. They will see it as a threat. And so what that will mean is that we will be in an arms race building nuclear weapons forever, mm-hmm. which is actually what happened. But that was Burns, I think, is the key figure. So the bomb was, if you look at what Burns was talking about, and if we had most of the discussions between Secretary of State Burns and Harry Truman were personal discussions privately. They were old drinking buddies. We have very few records of what they actually said to each other. We do know that that's where the decisions were made. We know a lot about what they thought. And the best estimate of what was going on was that Burns really wanted to use the bomb, and primarily because he saw its role in not so much in ending the war. The war was going to end anyway without an invasion, but because of implications of, might scare the Russians both in Manchuria and Eastern Europe. So that's very hard to pin down, but that's the best we can do with the available documents. And maybe someday a good friend of mine, an investigative journalist, believes that there are documents. If you really dig, you're going to find them in somebody's basement or some long-standing nephew who inherited a box of papers that he didn't know what to do with, and we'll get a bit better picture. But that's about as good as we can do at this point, because Burns, for instance, one last thing about the chief advisor, Burns, this will give you an evidence of his way of operating in the world. He had his special assistant with a man named Brown, and Brown kept a diary of what was going on, and Burns got hold of the diary, rewrote it, and then filed it in the official documents. And when historians would come up to him and say, well, what about what happened with the bombing and what happened to all this? Well, there's a diary from my assistant. You can go over to the archives, and that'll probably give you all you need to know, which was the diary that Burns had privately edited and rewritten favorable to him. He was a very slippery character.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, and it's so important, like you say, that, you know, this whole idea, yeah, we'll scare them, and then what? They'll leave power and go home? Or what's going to happen then? The obvious thing is, as you say, people warned in advance, and of course is how it played out, was the Soviets embarked on a crash course to get an A-bomb as fast as they could, and they got one within 3 years. And then, within that same 3 years, America lost China to Mao and the communists anyway. And so that whole thing about giving us an advantage in Manchuria by calling a premature halt to the Soviet invasion on Japan's western flank there was null and void anyway. So yes, the whole thing, even the ulterior motive is some bogus garbage.
Well, it's in a certain degree, it's at least some of the conservatives in the U.S. government. And again, I came away with high respect for some of these old conservatives, which I don't start from a conservative position myself. So Secretary of War was a man named Henry L. Stimson, a very conservative Republican that Roosevelt had appointed. And he was, in fact, oversaw the generals who built the bombing, Secretary of War. And he understood the danger in just the way you had said. If we use the bomb in a way that's irresponsible, the Russians will have to build a bomb because they will see it as necessary, and they will be in an arms race, and that these things can destroy the world. So he desperately wanted Truman to approach the Russians to some kind of a deal so that we wouldn't end up where we did end up. And this is another conservative. This is Henry L. Stimson, one of the leading conservative figures in modern 20th century history. And he made a desperate attempt to do it, and again, lost the battle to people like Burns, who had no interest in all. They as Stimson put it, the Russians will see us with this weapon rather ostentatiously on our hip, and they will know what to do. And that's actually what happened, of course. And here we are with nuclear weapons everywhere, and so far we've been lucky.
Yep. And America did actually end up, well, some Americans at least ended up helping the Russians with their bomb anyway. So they split the difference on the policy, but without any of the trust building, only with the atomic bomb delivering. So it's sort of like having John Bolton prevent the North Koreans from advancing their nuclear program for you. In a year or two, they'll have A-bombs.
Yep. It's a tragic story. You know, because here we are with nuclear weapons everywhere, and it would have been very difficult to prevent an arms race. It would not have been difficult to prevent the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and basically all mostly civilian lives. That would have been relatively easy. It would have taken great diplomacy to work out a thoughtful solution in advance. So Oppenheimer was also, for many, many people within the government and many conservatives, are trying to advance as well as liberals, are trying to advance an arms control program at the outset. But Truman and Burns were having none of it. Their strategy was push production and get ahead, just keep getting ahead, which meant there would be a worldwide arms race, and there was no serious the efforts that were made about arms control and disarmament have been examined by many researchers, and they're pretty fraudulent. It could not have been accepted by the Russians as put forward. Mm-hmm.
Well, I sure wish I'd read both of these books that you've written about this. Are there any other major kind of themes that are in there that we should know about?
The first book, which is the first book I wrote on this, was called Atomic Diplomacy, because it shows how U.S. policy towards the Russians in 1945, just in the period we're talking about, after the Germans surrendered in May 8th of 1945, the bomb was used in August, and the Japanese surrendered shortly thereafter. So that period, there are now diaries available which show how they began to, U.S. policymakers began to calculate what happens if we have this new weapon, they began talking about it as the ace in the hole. So they began seeing it as a very powerful weapon, primarily against the Russians, as well as the Japanese war. But they were thinking more about diplomacy. And I wrote a book about that called Atomic Diplomacy, based basically on the diaries of the particularly the Secretary of War's diaries became available when I was doing research on this. And they're just extraordinary diaries because he talks about all of this. And pretty much the way I'm talking about it, it's nothing's hidden. So that's one line. But later on, that's the it's called Atomic Diplomacy, Hiroshima and Potsdam, the Potsdam Conference where Stalin and Truman met in Germany at the time, just before Hiroshima, to American diplomacy. But the second book I wrote is called The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb. And it is a very detailed discussion with all of these military leaders, which goes beyond the first book, looking at the impact of the bomb on diplomacy, but how precisely did it impact the decision and how was it made and what do we know about precisely who controlled the decision making and step by step as best we can, because a lot of it was done privately between Truman, as I said, and this man, Secretary of State Burns, who had been his kind of teacher in the Senate and who kind of ran the show during those first 6 months of the Truman administration. A lot of it's there privately between them, but you can dig out people who understood what was going on, and you have to piece the story together. It's kind of a mystery story, but the basic points are clear. They saw it as a weapon against the Russians, and Burns was the key figure.
Mm. Well, we've got, I guess the good news is that there are only a couple of 10,000 of these on the planet now, whereas before, there were total almost, 100,000 of these nukes, something like that, or 80, 90,000 of these things in the hands of the U.S. and the USSR at the height of the Cold War buildup, right?
Yeah, we're in a little bit better position, but it's not a very happy position. There's an awful lot of these things around.
Yeah. It's funny to think of George H.W. Bush, in a way, despite all of the, you know, 30-year war in Iraq that he started and all this stuff, in a way, like from a quantifiable, sort of measurable point of view, he may be the greatest man who ever existed in the sense of signing those last few disarmament treaties with Gorbachev and then with Yeltsin in just the last 2 years of his government there at the end of the Cold War. I mean, has any other man ever gotten rid of tens of thousands of nukes? And he shares that, of course, with Gorbachev and with Yeltsin, too. I only learned recently, I guess, that it was in January of 93 when he only had 2 weeks left in office. He went to Russia because, of course, the red flag came down on Christmas Day, 91. So then just, 3 weeks later, he got on a plane and signed a whole new treaty with Yeltsin. You know, since it was going to take too long for Bill Clinton to get started on his negotiations, let's go ahead and get rid of another couple of 10,000 of these things. Shrug. I hate to give that old SOB credit, but that's pretty great.
Yeah, it's a very, he has a, on this issue, I think you're absolutely right. People don't recognize and credit him. And also the, I'm blocking the name of the man who was the national security advisor, who was
Scowcroft.
An aircraft. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And who actually was running this and guiding this strategy.
Larry and he was another former general.
Yeah, former general. The, uh-huh. There's Seymour Hersh's, if you, the you know, the great reporter, mm-hmm. he has also writes in a different vein, not about this particular subject, but he has the same view of some of the generals and admirals, that some of them are really quite interesting and quite thoughtful. And you know, we usually think of the military guys as they want to bomb everybody. And there certainly were people like that, like Curtis LeMay, who had, you know, insane views of using the bomb. But there also were a number of people, and you just named a couple, on the inside who were military figures who were very thoughtful about what this all, you know, they'd seen a lot of death and they knew what bombs and could do to people and to communities, and they didn't like war. You
know? Yeah.
You know, so there, I came away with respect for some of these old admirals and generals that I was surprised, you know, about once I learned what they really were talking about.
See, I wonder if all that wisdom is just spent. You know, I talked with Peter Van Buren and he says, you know what, nukes are so horrible that we can trust that even the worst politicians know better than ever to really use them. But it seems like any of that kind of wisdom built up during the Cold War is spent when I look at the kind of idiocy in terms of, especially in terms of America's position against Russia and Eastern Europe right now. And no matter what fight we pick with them, we always pretend that their response is the aggression, you know, like Israel and Palestine or something. And to such a degree, and you can tell that the people in D.C., they really believe it. Everything is Russian aggression. It's raining. It's Russian aggression. And they're, you know, have terrified themselves into believing they're really on the defensive as they expand our military alliance right up to their borders and do coup d'etats against all their friendly governments in the region and expand, you know, military presence, arm up Ukraine and all of these things. And I recall an NPR interview with a think tank expert who was a former ambassador, and this was in the worst part of the Ukraine war in the aftermath of the coup of 2014. And he was saying, yes, we have to arm up Ukraine in this war. We should send them all these Lockheed products and all these things. And the NPR reporter says, well, okay, so if we make the Kiev government stronger then in the war in the east, well, okay, to what end? Then what's next? And he says, well, we think that if a bunch of dead Russians start coming home in body bags, that will cause the debate to go up. Like Shades of Burns, right? We're going to scare them. Yeah, and then what? And this guy says, yeah, we're going to cause the debate to go up in Russia. The idea being that the angry moms of the dead guys will just be angry at Putin for getting them killed, not maybe angry at the USA for getting them killed. And that they're going to want to back down rather than maybe getting really angry and doubling down. It's as though the negative possibility is just outside of the realm of possibility. Even though the whole war was the backlash of the coup not going their way, it was supposed to be easy and it caused a war. Now they're going to, and you can just see the thinking, like, this is a former ambassador. This is the brightest of the think tank world is saying, we really thought this through. We're going to cause their debate to go up. When what he's really saying is he might cause a world war. You know? So I don't know. I don't trust it. I think it's sort of like, all these guys are just George W. Bush waiting to blunder us into another catastrophe at any minute is sort of how I feel about it.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And the tragedy is these guys actually believe, you know, it's really odd because I think a lot of what you're saying is true. And they believe this is the way to help the world. You know, that's where they're coming from. This is going to do good rather than seeing how short-sighted some of it is.
Right.
So there's a great historian, historian named William Appleman Williams, who wrote a lot about this. And he wrote a book called The Tragedy of American Diplomacy. Because these guys actually believe what they're doing is going to be great for the world. And what happens is the sort of thing you're talking about, because it's just so short-sighted in many, many, many areas that it produces a backlash and just the opposite of what you want.
Yeah. And that also helps explain why it's so hard to talk them out of any of it. Because you're essentially asking them to stop caring about people when you're asking them to stop bombing people to death. And they just think, how can we abandon them now?
Yes, exactly.
You know, we have to keep the war going. We hear this about Afghanistan daily, right?
Yeah, it's a genuine tragedy, not a phony one.
Yeah.
And outrageous and very costly in human life and, you know, destruction and arms races. And so far, we've been lucky that these things haven't gone off. But, you know, what's going on in India and Pakistan may be the next question.
Yeah, well, I got that right. But I'll let you go with that one. So thank you very much for coming on the show, Gar. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Enjoy talking with you.
Okay, guys. Oops. That is American historian Gar Alperwitz, and he wrote Atomic Diplomacy, Hiroshima and Potsdam, and also The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb. And if you missed it, we ran it on antiwar.com a couple weeks back, but you can find it here at The Nation. The war was won before Hiroshima, and the generals who dropped the bomb knew it. All right, y'all, thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/scotthortonshow. Oh, yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.